Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Melinda Pillsbury Foster, Thursdays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, along with co-host Gene DiNardo, who's sitting in this week for Melinda Pillsbury Foster. Jake Towne probably won't be joining us tonight either, but Gene and I will be carrying you through for the next hour on this December 23rd, 2010, 2 days before Christmas. And Gene, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Walt. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, too. And we've got a lot to talk about because we're near the end of the year. And this is, of course, when all the predictions come out. All the economists decide they're going to say what's going to happen in the coming 12 months. Of course, the record hasn't been particularly good lately, but nevertheless, we're going to take a look at that. And we're also going to look at some of the other news items of the day, including an interesting story that you have, Gene, about what's going on with Wall Street computers. What are the details on that one, Gene?
Well, the computer trading on Wall Street it's really just grown into this enormous thing. And I was watching, I think it was a 60 Minutes show on it, and what they do is they actually, any property that's close, they were saying any property that's close to the Wall Street headquarters just goes for enormous prices because these computer firms, they want to buy this property, or the trading firms actually, and they install these computers, and the closer you are to Wall Street, I guess the microseconds, you get the news quicker, you get the stock reports, and they can enter their computer trading in, and it's just a phenomenal amount of Wall Street trading now that's done on computers. It's just taking over, basically. But anyway, this report, which was in today's paper, New York Times, and the title is The Wall Street Computers Are Accessing News Reports. And it says, the number crunchers on Wall Street are starting to crunch something else, the news. Math-loving traders are using computers to speed-read news reports, editorials, company websites, blog posts, tweets, and then letting the machines decide what it all means for the markets. The development goes far beyond standard digital fare like most read an emailed list. In some cases, the computers are parsing writers' words, sentence structure, even the odd emoticon, like a wink and a smile, for instance, just might mean things are looking up for the markets. Then, often without human intervention at all, the programs are interpreting that news and trading on it. And it says the development, which is years in the making, is part of the technological revolution that is reshaping Wall Street. It's in a business where information is the most valuable commodity. Traders with the smartest, fastest computers can often outfox and outmaneuver rivals. Many of the robo-readers look beyond the numbers and try to analyze market sentiments, like the latest economic figures, news, and social media buzz. It's known as unstructured data and can shift the mood from exuberance to despondency. Goes on to say that news agencies such as Bloomberg, Dow Jones, Thomson Reuters have adopted the idea, offering services to supposedly help their Wall Street customers sift through the news automatically. And computer savvy traders known as quants are already paying attention, according to AITE Group, a financial service consulting company. About 35% of quantitative trading firms are exploring whether to use unstructured data feeds. And 2 years ago, only 2% of those firms used them. So this is just a geometric tangent from this computer thing. It's just going on and on to where, you know, a large percent of the trading will be done by computers, with very little concern, really, with the companies and their basic structures, and more just trying to turn a profit, a quick profit, whether it means you know, other people are going to be losing big money, or really has nothing to do with anything other than making money, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, it brings to mind something that most people are familiar with, but they haven't seen lately, and they haven't seen it for good reason. And that is in the pit, as they know, as it's known, on the floor of the wall of the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange. It used to be you would see the traders all in large groups, you know, bidding stocks up and down and so forth. And that's long gone. I mean, they don't actually show the trading floor anymore because it's boring. It's just been replaced by large computers. And the computers do most of the work, and there are some technicians who wander around. But you don't have the old-style auctioning going on anymore. It's all done by computer. And what you're describing, of course, is a logical extension of that. Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with computers, but it does raise the question. I mean, how accurate is this programming going to be, and what does it actually do, like you say, toward promoting the idea of distributing equities as opposed to simply trying to make a quick buck? Because if it's all about making a quick buck, we're going to see some pretty wild swings going on in the stock market in the years to come.
Yeah, it seems like it will become just commonplace rather than unusual. And the other thing is, you know, you think of your home, and of course, you know, they spend probably multi-million dollars on these computers, maybe billions, but you think of your home computer and how often, you know, it's on the blink and not working up to par, you know, and we're talking about, you know, the stock market here and, you know, one wrong move and how many people are invested, you know, through this computer.
Well, you mentioned how they were parsing through data, looking for things like emoticon winks and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, what if you have, like, a top influential trader who intends to put down a smiley and accidentally hits a semicolon instead of a colon? Does that set the market up 150 points?
Yeah, and then everybody follows the lead because, you know, the main thing that computers are doing is kind of watching the way the stocks are moving. And as the program, the 60 Minutes program was talking about is, you know, they have all this data. So, like, if a certain percentage of stocks in a certain sector, you know, lose a fraction of a point, that, you know, that might tip off one of the computers to sell. And, you know, of course, that, you know, feeds into it, and then another computer picks up on that. And, you know, it just goes back and forth. And it's just phenomenal, the amount of trading, you know, that's done now compared to, you know, even 10 years ago. It's just...
And it is known for a fact, of course, many people are aware of this, that the entire stock market has really gotten very far away from what its origins were. Its origins were a place where equities, where stock equities could be traded so that companies could raise money to do their business.
Yes, that's a great point. In fact, there's a book, I think it's called The Divine Right of Capital, and I'm trying to think of the author. I can't remember her name, but in the book, she said that that the amount of actual offerings is only 0.5%, I believe was the figure, of the total investment in stocks. So all the 99.5% is just people buying each other's stocks, or companies and firms buying each other's stocks. And then she said if you factor in the cost of for companies, corporations, and firms to buy back their stock, to repurchase them, that the capital, there's actually a 7 or 8% loss of capital in the stock market from the companies, which is just, in other words, the stocks, they're losing money having stocks, you know. So, you know, her whole point was, how much do these firms actually owe the investor, you know, the stockholder? You know, the investment was made years and years ago for the most part, you know, and it's an interesting point because, you know, I think by law, most firms are, you know, they have to look at the profit motive, you know, for the shareholder. You know, that's their main concern. And if they don't do that, and you know, the shareholder can bring a suit against them and sue them. And
of course, how do you prove that they didn't?
Yeah, it's a good point.
That's the really hard part. The other thing that captured my attention, though, and this is kind of what I was aiming at when I was starting to make my point earlier.
Uh-huh.
One of the things, of course, that is a major portion of stock market trading is options trading, not just in stock options, but also in options on commodities and futures and so on and so forth.
Yeah, right.
And within the Wall Street community, there is a segment of employees. These are usually math whizzes who are hired right out of college to do this kind of work. Basically, their job is to go through massive numbers of options that are placed, looking for ridiculous bets that were made, because there's a large portion of what goes on with options that is basically a major gambling system.
Yeah, right.
And that gambling system, it's basically a hedging mechanism that they're involved in. You know, they hedge by taking an option one way to offset another purchase, either another option or a stock purchase another way, so they're in a sense covering their bets.
Form of insurance, really, right?
Yeah, that's the way they're treating it. But the net result is you end up with traders who take bets like taking on an option that says that Apple, you know, one of the major stocks in America, Apple is currently trading around $300, $310 a share, that Apple's going to drop to $15 a share. You know, I mean, the likelihood of that happening is probably less than winning, you know, the state lottery. But nevertheless, there are people who take these plays like that to provide themselves that this protection, this insurance protection. And so you have these math whizzes who just go through reams and reams of options looking for those and just taking the other side of the bet on each one of them and just reaping huge amounts of money for the major brokerages. They're actually called stock hackers.
They're called stock hackers.
Stock hackers, yes. Their job is to hack through the options, looking for all these easy money things so they can just, you know, grab, you know, $500 here, $1,000 there, $3,000 there, you know, bang, bang.
Small amounts that add up because, you know, the odds are so highly against them. I'm sure the amounts are small, but, you know, if you take enough of them. And,
right.
And these other people, you know, they're trying to protect their investment, thinking that if the worst-case scenario happens, we'll have something to fall back on. Is that the idea, or...? The people who are taking the option. Say that they're
which idea are you talking about? Are you talking about the hackers or the people that they're taking the money from?
The people
from?
They're taking advantage of.
Yeah, the ones who are, they're taking the money from have all kinds of different theories about how they're offsetting their risk by playing these various option plays.
Huh.
How good are they? I mean, if you look at the actual numbers of the people who are regularly involved in options, there's a very small percentage who make money and the vast majority lose money. So that should give you a clue.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's very much of a casino-type marketplace.
Yeah, well, similar, it kind of reminds me of the credit default swaps where, like AIG and all the other insurance companies were taking the best thinking that they would never, you know, come due. They were just collecting these premiums and thinking that basically the housing market would always stay strong is what most of them were built on. And then, you know, they built the CDOs on top of these, the synthetic CDO or synthetic credit. Let's see, what is it? What CDO stand for? Credit?
Credit default option?
No.
I'm not sure what it is, actually. I'm guessing.
Yeah. Anyway, what they would do is they would take these credit default swaps. So AIG would have the premium coming in. A guy would bet on a bundle of mortgages, you know, and he was betting that... they would fail, and AIG was betting that they weren't fail. So they'd have these premium comes in, they collect a bunch of premiums from different investors, and they'd be getting them, and then they would build these securities on these premiums. You know, so they just kept, and those were the synthetic ones, and they just kept extending this out, and until it got to where all of a sudden it didn't work.
And what this is all terribly reminiscent of is what happened leading up to the crash of 1929.
That's true.
Because that crash was characterized, now of course the dirty secret that never gets reported about the crash of 29 and the roaring 20s was that it was all driven by monetary expansion, not currency expansion. That's an important point. Currency levels actually remained relatively flat throughout that period, but currency is not the only form of money. Bank deposits also count as money, and it was the bank deposits that were going through the roof and was leading to all kinds of lending, and it just kind of pyramided into this huge lending thing where people were borrowing against anything they could borrow against just to invest in the stock market.
So rather than printing of currency by the Federal Reserve, it was based on the bank fractional reserve system where they were just giving more and more loans.
Exactly, and in fact, that's a really important point that I try to bring out as much as I can. When we talk about the Fed printing money, and you hear that term a lot, people talk about the Fed printing money. The Fed actually never prints money. It never, ever prints
archaic
money.
Term, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't say never. Obviously, there are Federal Reserve notes, so it does print some money, but it doesn't go out of its way to print a whole bunch more of actual paper notes. It always does it through the mechanism of fractional reserve banking, as you said, Gene, which is basically just, you know, using credit to pyramid more credit to pyramid more credit and basically build up bank accounts so that the total bank deposit numbers get larger and larger, larger and become spendable money.
Which is based, for the listeners, on the requirements that they have on banks for a certain percentage of reserves, which I think they go anywhere from 3 to 10%.
Well, it's 10%, I believe, for all deposits above the first. I think it's the first 100 million that a bank holds,
uh-huh.
And anything below that, I don't think has any reserve at all.
Yeah, and that was done to favor to give a break to the local banks who they don't have access to the inexpensive money like the Goldman Sachs firms and all the big investment banks.
Right. Of course, and that results in that they end up failing at a higher rate as well, too. So you get one going with the other.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't want to interrupt you here, but I did have something I wanted to ask you. It was an interesting comment. And it was right in the same, based on the banking reserves and the fractional system. And it was an article in Forbes. And the guy was saying that... you know, this buildup of the expansion of the money supply, he was saying that people are saying that it's not occurring now, but he was logically pointing out that the banks, even though they're not loaning at the rate, they're buying securities. You know, they have their reserves built up, and they're on top of their reserves, they're buying lots of securities. And he said that had the same effect. You're increasing the money supply by purchasing securities. The banks were. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, it's true. I mean, because they're using money to buy in the same sense that they use money to lend. So it certainly does increase the money supply. What kind of effect does that have? It's going to be a different effect than you're going to get from lending money out, because the banks become direct players rather than indirect players.
Right.
But nevertheless, oh, sure, there's definitely something going on there. One thing we do have to keep in mind, the major impact of the bailouts of the banks, of the large corporations and so forth, of McDonald's and Harley Davidson. I still like that one. They bailed out Harley Davidson. You know, America was
absolutely. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the reports that came out when the Fed, remember in the legislation that got passed this past July, the I believe they called it the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010.
Right.
President Obama signed it into law. One of the provisions of that was a watered-down version of audit the Fed. And and the net result was the Fed had to follow the provisions of that past law. Of course, it was exactly what they had asked for, so they weren't unhappy doing it. But nevertheless, it did have a few revelations, and some of the revelations were that besides bailing out the banks and those companies that we knew about, they also bailed out GE, they bailed out McDonald's. Because I mean, you know, we can't have enough plastic hamburgers, so it becomes very important to make sure we continue to have a supply of them, you know.
Right.
Otherwise, the entire economy would fall apart.
That's true. And not to mention French fries.
Yeah, absolutely. Despite the fact that they've taken all the flavor out of the French fries, those are vital to the economy.
They actually used to be food, I guess.
Well, they took out, I can't think what they're called, but the bad fat, supposedly.
Yeah, and that's an amazing feat. I mean, how did they do that out of a French fry? In a lab, obviously.
Well, anyway, McDonald's was essential to the economy, so they were bailed out. Harley-Davidson, you can't have enough Harley-Davidson hogs driving down the highway, so that would have absolutely destroyed the economy if they went belly up. And there was a whole list of companies that the Fed bailed out, but it just goes to show how crazy that whole bailout system was. I want to come back to your point that you had started to raise with your question, which is the nature of what happens when you increase the money supply through the banking system.
Mm-hmm.
I've come up with an analogy, and I want to see what you think of the analogy. The analogy is what I call the incredible shrinking tape measure. Now, the incredible shrinking tape measure, imagine, and I'm actually going to do a video about this, and I'm going to do a whole thing with a Harry Potter magic wand and so forth, and make the tape measure shrink in size and so forth. But the idea of the incredible shrinking tape measure is this. If you're a builder, for instance, you do construction, and a tape measure obviously is going to play a role in what you're doing, because you want to make sure you have, you know, all your walls are square and all that kind of thing, and everything falls in exactly where it's going to be. And in fact, we depend upon our tape measures and our yardsticks and our rulers to have marked increments that are the same from instrument to instrument. That's how we know an inch is always an inch, and a meter is always a meter, and so on and so forth.
And so we can communicate, actually.
Well, what would happen if our tape measures shrunk over time? It would make it really difficult to build things, first of all. And in the course of, say, 50 years, what we used to know as an inch would now be the equivalent of, say, a millimeter.
That's right.
You know? And it would make it very difficult for buildings to stand. It would make it very difficult for anything to stand that we measured and constructed. It simply would fall apart.
Uh-huh.
And then I turn that around and say, well, what if we do the same thing with the money supply?
That's exactly what that's a great analogy, I think.
I mean, the only thing that makes the analogy a little bit difficult to understand is the natural inclination of somebody who doesn't think about it would be to say, well, it's not like the physical dollar shrinks. And that's true. What we're talking about is what happens when you have a dollar being used as a measure of value. And when you basically increase, well, before I even say that part, in order to have a healthy economy, you have to have a money supply that is of a fixed supply. It has to be as close to an unchanging supply as possible, because that becomes your yardstick. That becomes your tape measure for knowing what your pricing is. And if your yardstick is changing, then you can't really trust the measurement.
Well, and we can't trust a measurement. I think that's the basis for the housing crisis.
Absolutely.
You know, the house is only worth so much, and, you know, it's you could say it's a fraction. I mean, a house is, you could, and banks do this, you know, when they give out loans for houses, I think they allow you a third of your gross income, I think, approximately, and they figure all kinds of other things into it. But
I think they've up to about 40% now, but still.
But yeah, they get, if prices go up, they got to crank it up.
But, well, of course, they have to have some way for people to be able to afford them.
and get the money. But as you, you know, as you lose this, like you say, the relationship, when your measuring tape no longer works, the house, you know, kind of goes beyond what it's actually worth, and it gets to some point where, you know, masses of people can't afford it, and then the downturn starts. And that's exactly, I mean, I think it's a great analogy. Where money is used, you know, as a measure of value, it has to be accurate. If it isn't, you know, we have all kinds of problems, and I really can't think of any other better way to explain it except you've lost your measure. And you know, there's all kinds of theories on how to, okay, if we say, you know, the way they're doing it, the way they're inflating the monetary supply and everything is wrong, then we get to the point, well, what is right? You know, what kind of system do you use? And that, I think that's an interesting question. I don't know if they'll give us the option, but...
Well, I'm sure they wouldn't, actually. What they would probably try to do is replace it with another fiat money system, and if they couldn't sell that, then they'd probably try to do something like the Greenbox, which, of course, was a fiat money system.
Yeah.
They try to find some way to keep the game going where they can continue to expand the money supply ad infinitum.
So they can extract value, because basically what they're doing is extracting value from
the money supply. That's right. And if we carry out the tape measure analogy a little bit further, if you're starting off with a tape measure that's regular length, where each inch is what we always know to be an inch, and then a few years later your inch is down to, say, half that size, you're now having to use twice as much material, it seems, to build your house.
Build the same.
The house that used to be 40 feet by 80 feet is now... It now has to be 80 feet by 160 feet in order to make it the same size as the old house.
Yeah, you've lost your gauge.
That's right.
And then people, and well, you know,
well, more than lost your gauge, what you've ended up with is an inflation of the measurements.
Exactly.
And there's where I think the analogy really works nicely, because it helps to explain what monetary inflation does. Monetary inflation basically drives the numbers up without having any real meaning associated with that increase in numbers.
Right. And I suppose you could say that would be okay if everything went up in the relatively the same proportion, but it doesn't, you know, and people get left out. And it still wouldn't be okay, because, you know, I think we always have to consider people who are on limited income or no income. I mean, the very poorest people who, you know, have relatively no income or little income, you know, any inflation is just terrible for them, and that would never change whether it's a 0.5%, you know, inflation or 25%.
Oh, sure, because usually that person's on a fixed income.
Right.
Which means they aren't keeping up with the increase in the number of dollars. Their income is not doubling as every time the money supply doubles.
Yeah, you know, if prices went up 100% and your wage went up 100% and, you know, it was relative, then you could say it's the same, but it can never be the same because that just never happens.
But, of course, there's actually another reason besides that, and that's a very good reason, the one you brought up about how it affects the lower classes and the poor and so forth, people on fixed incomes. But there's another reason why it's really bad for all of us to have an ever-increasing money supply, and that is we never find out how much it increased until long after the fact.
Right.
So we're making decisions based on what we think the money supply is. Actually, not so much what we think the money supply is, but what we think the pricing is and what we think the pricing is going to be. And we have really no idea where the pricing is going to be in a couple of years, but we have to assume it's going to be somewhat like what we have now. Otherwise, how can we possibly do our business calculations? How can we possibly budget our household income?
Exactly.
And that's where people end up getting in trouble, because they are misled by economic conditions into believing that the money is actually worth more than it is. And they're constantly misled in that way. Even when they know that there's some sort of a price increase coming, they're still misled because they don't know how much of an increase it's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to calculate. And,
that's right.
And, you know, it's not just impossible for the average person or for the average business person or for the average person who has an MBA or got a finance degree. It's impossible for the Federal Reserve. I mean, it's exactly what they're going through now. They're claiming they know what they're doing. You know, they're just throwing numbers out there and saying, okay, you know, the latest is, what, $600 billion we're going to add to the economy.
Which somebody actually, interestingly enough, pointed out is going to be roughly where the net deficit is going to be for the U.S. government.
Really?
Yeah. When all is said and done, when you add up all the budgetary proposals that are out there and how they're likely to play out, it turns out that we end up with roughly a $600 billion deficit. Interesting,
so it's coincidental,
interesting
then.
Thing. Well, I don't think it's coincidence. I think the Fed is anticipating it.
Yeah, and I think they're basically buying treasury bonds and stuff, right?
Yeah, and basically what that means is the Fed felt it had to step in and do that because it knew that there would not be a market to be able to sell those treasury bonds and treasury bills.
So
they had to fill it in order to keep the whole game afloat.
To keep the treasury bond market going. Right?
And this is absolutely the worst possible way to finance a government. Even the traditional economists don't like this. Let alone people like you and I who believe in the Austrian economics. Most economists don't believe in that. Most people who are in the economics profession favor this kind of expansionary monetary system. But even they don't like the idea of the Fed basically creating money out of thin air in order to finance the government. That's what's known as monetizing the debt. And that's the thing that they're all afraid of because they know that's what usually leads to a short-term price inflation.
Now, would the Chicago School be against it also?
They would.
That's called the monetary school, right?
The Chicago School are the monetarists, Milton Friedman being their most prominent spokesman, although he has since passed on. But yes, they would actually be opposed to it because the monetary school believes that you want to have a slow increase in the money supply and that the increase in the money supply should match the projected growth rate for the national GDP.
Okay, so you want to monitor it.
That's their idea, and their claim is that if you can do that, and they would actually claim that we have done that fairly successfully over the last 50 years or so, if you can do that, they claim, then your prices are going to be relatively stable compared to everyone's income.
Right.
But the truth is, that's not true.
So they even think that the... What's their view on the housing boom and bust then? They don't think that was caused by the money supply then?
They do. They think that the Federal Reserve went too far in terms of monetizing, in terms of increasing the money supply.
Okay.
So they consider themselves to be prudent by comparison to where the Fed was.
Right.
Which is actually a bunch of nonsense, because if you look at what happened to the value of the dollar during the time when Friedmanite Chicago School monetary policy was quote-unquote successfully followed, what you see is that the dollar lost roughly 95% of its value.
Right.
So
And
during that same period, the cost of living virtually doubled.
And wages didn't keep up.
Right, they didn't keep up. They didn't rise as fast as the prices rose. So basically, when the ideal Friedmanite model was followed and met, we still lost.
But they still believe in it.
Oh, yeah, they still believe in it. They're absolutely convinced that that's the best way to go.
Well, I guess. So they're kind of Keynesians with a little bit of restraint, I guess you'd say.
Well, we'll talk about some more Keynesians and Friedmanites in a minute because we want to get to the economic forecast for the next year, but we're up to break time, so let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back in a minute to talk about that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back.
You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be? All right.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and I'm here with a healthy holiday tip. Want to avoid putting on all those extra pounds during the holidays? Don't skimp on eating healthy foods before any festivity thinking you will save on calories. You will only be tempted to eat more. I recommend eating a big salad and steamed greens before going to a party where you know there will be lots of decadent treats. You can go for small bites of different treats, but won't be stuffing yourself too much with rich food. No matter what you choose to eat, enjoy it. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. where you can call in and ask questions about my favorite subject, food. Have a great holiday season.
Hey, Did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry. PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Dr. Molly Barrow with a holiday tip. The holidays can add extra stress to your busy life. Try to remember that this season is about love and not a performance that is graded. Relax. Tell people that you care with a kind word, a smile, and a helpful hand. Think about what this holiday means to you and remember that you get to enjoy it too. This is Dr. Molly Barrow wishing you a joyous season filled with delicious food, great friends, and loving family. From all of us at Progressive Radio Network, happy holidays.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Evolution, well, you know.
We're back here on the Freedom News Hour. And before we get into it, just want to remind our listeners that you can always check the website at freedomnewshour.com to find out who our upcoming guests are. And in fact, if you check it today, you'll see that next week we have an interesting guest coming on. His name is Peter Cohan, and Peter is a blogger at AOL's Daily Finance. He wrote a blog entry on December 13th entitled Seven Ways Ron Paul is Wrong About the Fed. Ron Paul, of course, being Congressman Ron Paul from Texas, who in January is scheduled to take over the House Subcommittee on Domestic Policy, Domestic Monetary Policy, which, of course, is the subcommittee that oversees the Fed. And, in fact, a lot of Fed watchers are anticipating that the exchanges that take place between Congressman Paul and Chairman Ben Bernanke are going to be particularly interesting to watch this year. But anyway, Mr. Cohan believes that a lot of Ron Paul's beliefs about the Fed are wrong, and he's going to come on the program and explain to us why they're wrong. So it should be an interesting time because, of course, we happen to believe that Ron Paul is right. So you want to tune into that one. That's going to be a good one.
We have to be nice to him.
We will be nice to him. This will be a very polite conversation, but nevertheless, we're going to show him why he's wrong. Anyway, it should
put
be fun.
It bluntly.
But anyway, we are now coming in toward the end of the new year, and Gene, you and I have both been doing some digging into finding out what the various experts are saying in terms of what's going to happen in the year 2011. And I'm not sure what you found in your research, but the one thing that I have found that struck me more than anything else is that the prediction that we keep talking about here on the Freedom News Hour about how the mortgage resets are going to peak toward the end of next year and that this is going to lead to quite possibly another financial meltdown, nobody's talking about it. And that's been true for quite some time, but even with the economic predictions, nobody's talking about mortgage resets.
No, they aren't. The article that I dug up, which was Associated Press, did, you know, it had all kinds of positive things to say what's going to happen, but it did mention that, well, I'll read it right here. It said the National Association of Realtors reported Wednesday that more people bought previously owned homes in November. The sales pace rose 5.6% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.68 million units. But even with the gain, sales are still well below what analysts consider a healthy pace, you know, whatever that is. And then it says, it went on to say that, you know, the sector that they don't see as a positive is still the housing sector. But they did, like you said, they don't mention anything about the mortgage resets or anything like that.
You know, you mentioned the level of home sales and of mortgages being purchased and so forth. Another article from the Wall Street Journal entitled Fannie and Freddie Report Mixed Mortgage Delinquency Data. At the end of that article, a very interesting comment. The article says, refinance loan purchase volume was $38 billion, up 15% of the month. And that made up 82% of the total of mortgage purchases and issuances, which means only 18% of all mortgages issued were for people buying a home.
Actually, buying a home. The rates are so low, they want to refinance, right?
Well, not only do they want to refinance, they're trying to get out from underneath the crazy situations they got themselves into in the first place.
Yeah.
And yet, despite all that fact, we're still facing large numbers of foreclosures, we're currently in a relative drop period. The mortgage foreclosures have dropped over the last month or so, but everybody agrees that it's because of the robo-signing crisis, and it's the courts basically slowing the whole process down, so that's why the number of actual foreclosures is down.
Right,
and everybody expected to pick up again next year.
Well, weren't you saying last week or a week before that they expected over a million foreclosures next year also?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's going higher than it was in 2010. There's going to be actually more foreclosures, despite having the HART programs, despite having all these people trying to refinance their mortgages and so forth. There's still going to be more foreclosures next year than there were this year.
So there'll be plenty of supply. I mean, there's not going to be a problem finding a house. You know, the other thing is we're at the very lowest percentage possible, really. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but I think the overnight rate is 0.26% lending rate, and, you know, they're doing everything they can to keep the percentage for mortgages down. And I've seen actually 30-year mortgages advertised at just under 4%, which is just phenomenally low. So any little bump, you know, in the interest rate will just make houses more expensive and just worsen the problem, you know.
And as Jake pointed out last week, despite all that fact and despite the fact that the so-called QE2, the Quantitative Easing Part 2 that Mr. Bernanke has put out, it's supposedly designed to help keep those interest rates low and bring them down lower, the response that the market had, both within the bond market and the mortgage market, was to drive the rates up.
Which is really interesting.
Which basically means that the market is saying, yeah, we don't buy for a minute that this is all about trying to keep deflation under control. We think there's an inflation coming along.
Yeah.
And that's what the reality is that Mr. Bernanke doesn't want to face up to. I still think that the resets are going to be a major issue in 2011, and I'm just really shocked that none of the economists are talking about it, because there's really no excuse this time around. Last time around, of course, was September 20, 2008, when Lehman Brothers and all the others started, you know, falling by the wayside. Fannie and Freddie were basically at death's door. And
they weren't talking about it then either.
Well, actually, they were, because
they were beforehand.
Well, because that was the subprime crisis.
Yeah.
The subprimes were all resetting.
Yeah, you know that. Yeah, that's true, because they were there was quite a few people actually. They were mentioning there were problems in the subprime area, and they were really increasing those loans right the last 2 years before the drop. So.
And all the economists know about the Credit Suisse graph, which shows that. At the around September, October 2008, that's when the subprimes were going to peak in terms of the number of resets they had, and sure enough, that's when they peaked. And they also know that same graph shows that in autumn of 2011, next year, we get a peak, this time in option ARM and Alt-A mortgages, roughly at the same level as we had with the subprimes in 2008.
Really?
Now, a lot of them are still claiming that because Bernanke has forced the interest rates down so low, mortgages that are adjustable mortgages can conceivably can adjust either up or down. So I think a lot of these economists have basically decided that these adjustable rate mortgages are resetting downward, so they're going to take pressure off of those homeowners. But there's a huge factor that they're overlooking. And that factor, as far as I can see, is that the overwhelming majority of people who took the option ARM mortgages, for example, a key factor about an option ARM mortgage, the way that they're structured, you can take on the mortgage and pay interest only for the first X number of years, depending on how the loan is structured. And when it comes time for a reset, it will reset up anyway, regardless of where the interest rates are, because you have to start paying principal off.
So it automatically goes up. It doesn't go with the prevailing rate.
And option ARMs account for about, I think it's about one-third to one-half of the resets that are scheduled to peak in the fall of 2011.
Yeah, at the very least, that's a huge impact.
That's right. Now, that assumes that we get to stay at the current interest rate level. But here's the thing. One of the things that is common to all the economic predictions that are coming out now, and I'm sure you saw the same kind of thing, is that we are now in the recovery stage. We're going to see, I think the standard answer from most of the Wall Street economists was 3.5% growth rate next year.
Yeah, that's right.
Lots of people talking about a stock market boom, which after what we talked about with the way the trading works, that certainly could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also talking about fundamentals, why they think the fundamentals are behind that. And if what they're saying is true, I mean, we know that when you throw money into the situation, eventually the economy comes back. Well, at least it seems to come back because it's being fed all this money, and all that money is getting out into the system and creating the illusion of another round of prosperity.
It has in the past, right.
And there's every reason to believe that it will eventually do the same thing
right.
here, too. Well, there's every reason to believe that's going to be happening in 2011. We've been through 3 years of downtime. That's typically, historically, that's about how long it takes before it starts to kick back into gear when they're, you know, as they've been throwing the money into the economy, and it can take a while where it seems like nothing's happening, but eventually it starts to kick into gear, the banks start to lend it out and so forth.
Right.
Well, if that happens in 2011, we can say bye-bye to the low interest rates, because at that point, everybody's going to be saying, inflation, inflation, we got to rein it in, and how's the Fed going to rein it in? They're going to rein it in by raising the interest rates.
And there's trillions of dollars just sitting around in reserves, in banks, or you know, in securities, and just waiting to be spent. You know, that's the kind of danger I think. If it does take off, it could take off really fast. I mean, there's
well, even if it doesn't take off fast, I can conceive of a pattern where it takes off at what they would consider to be the ideal rate, a nice smooth increase.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't think it necessarily will, but let's assume for the sake of discussion it does. Even if that happens, the Fed now still gets the tremendous pressure on it to raise the rates. And the moment they raise the rates, they're going to push it back up above the levels that we're at in 2008, because interest rates weren't all that high in 2008. A lot of people seem to believe that interest rates were very, very high. They weren't all that high. They were a little bit higher than they are now, maybe a point or two higher, but they weren't. It wasn't like they were up in the 8 to 9, 10% range.
No, mortgages were under 6%.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's not going to take a lot to push everything back up into that same range again. And the moment that happens, all of a sudden all these mortgage resets become really critical.
That's true.
So
when they say we're going to have a million foreclosures next year, how do they view that aspect of it, or don't they? I mean,
I think they're basing that on what they know about that the banks are currently pursuing.
So that's not even a factor.
On delinquency rates and so forth.
Yeah. So that's not even a factor.
I don't think they're factoring in the resets. I really don't. And that's really frightening, because what we could be facing next year is the one thing that those of us who favor the Austrian school approach have always feared the most, and that is a stagflation depression.
Stagflation depression.
Where you actually have a combination of recession, depression, whatever you want to call it, with inflation, even double-digit inflation.
Yeah.
The last time we had that, of course, was under the Carter administration in 1979, 1980, and it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating.
Yeah, I think at one point the mortgage rates were 15%. I mean, and it basically what happened is nobody took out loans for houses. Housing prices, and Oregon got hit really bad. That was, the fall of the timber industry because housing crashed.
That's right. Yep.
Oregon was very timber dependent at that time. It isn't anymore. But so everybody was out of work. I think the housing went down 40%. But when you bought a house, it was interesting because this is our first house that we bought. Was called a land sales contract.
I mean, and by the way, you live in Oregon. We should point that out to our listeners.
I live in Portland, right? And at the time, we were in Bend. And, houses were cheap. We thought, we should buy one. And what happens is the owners of the houses would carry the contract. You know, you wouldn't be involved with the bank or not. And they would give, I think the percentage was 8% the guy gave us. And, usually the contracts were shorter because it's an individual, not a bank.
But that's not going to work this time around.
No, because nobody owns anything.
Well, not only that, the contracts are now written in such a way that most of the mortgage contracts won't allow a second.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, this guy was an older guy, and he actually owned the home outright, and he just carried the whole loan.
If that's the case, then yes, that'll be a possibility.
But
most of them are trying to write a second on a first, and that's not going to work anymore.
But how many people own their homes outright? I mean, I think back then, I think the further you go back, the more common it was. But now it's like it's really a stretch for one thing, And this is all interdependent. Prices are so high. I mean, and when prices are high, you know, it's harder, of course, for individuals to own their own homes. Well, that kind of favors the banks right there. You loan out the money, you boost the prices, and pretty soon you got, you monopolize the whole capital industry for the, housing. I mean, it's kind of a catch-22.
Add in the fact that the way that they combated the stagflation of 79, 80, and the early 80s was through raising interest rates dramatically. And that was definitely a Fed action to do that. The net result was that people ended up going bankrupt in large numbers.
Yeah.
And what's particularly important about that is what those large numbers were. Large numbers at that time was in the few hundred thousand to, say, a half a million.
For bankruptcy.
These days, even before we're into that kind of a scenario, we already have bankruptcy numbers in the millions. And, in fact, I did a story a week or two back in which I found two different sources. One was a website of basically the government, the federal government court system tracking delinquencies and foreclosures. And the other one was a major mailing list company, InfoUSA, also doing the same thing through the small courts. And they came up with drastically different numbers. So the one source found that the mortgages, the bankruptcies were in the range of like 1 to 3 million people a month, whereas the other one was fine. I'm sorry, 1 to 3 million people a year, whereas the other one was finding it to be in the range of like 15 to 20 million a year.
They were that far off.
Yeah, they were that far off, and I still haven't been able to find out why that discrepancy is so big.
Yeah,
but it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference because either way, it's way above the say half a million figure that was the peak. In the early 1980s. So we're going to be talking about gigantic amounts of people going bankrupt.
And way above for the proportion for even the population increase.
I mean, the bottom line is the population cannot tolerate the kind of rate increase that it's going to take to stop the inflation.
No, I think everything's pushed to the very edge right now. I mean, that's, you know, and I think even Bernanke, you know, sees that. And you know, I can't rationalize what he's doing, but you know, I think they just realize that they just kind of at their last straw, and they're hoping, you know, they're hoping that everything's going to be okay.
Well, I can rationalize what they're doing. What they're doing is basically trying to preserve upper-end capital.
Right.
I mean, that's been the pattern
problem.
All the way along.
And
it's basically driving more and more people into what we might call the poor range, and basically eliminating the middle class over the long haul. If you continue that pattern, the middle class ends up disappearing.
Yeah, it goes one direction or the other. You get a few people moving into the top tier and most people going
down
to the bottom.
And but I think that's okay with the Fed. I think that they don't want to say that publicly, but privately that would be okay with them because that way they can continue to show growth numbers, even though the growth isn't applying to the vast majority of the population.
Yeah, but, you know, at some point, but that's a, you know, there's a scale. It's like a natural scale. At some point, it just, the system doesn't work anymore. I mean, and I don't know if we're close to that, but I mean, you can't push everybody into the bottom. And, well, I guess you can. You can go back to the days of the monarchies and stuff like that. You know?
Yeah, welcome feudalism, yeah.
Yeah, feudalism in the 21st century.
Well, we're not all that far apart from it because if you look at the way the corporate structure and the banking structure is, it's basically the setup for a new feudal society. It's certainly a very definite parallel.
Yeah, the amount, the concentration of wealth is just, and I just don't think, you know, you can argue the numbers, you know, the wealth is concentrated at this percentage, but there's just no way in a freer economy, even, you know, 10% freer, you know, not a completely free economy, that, you know, capital disperses itself. That's the nature of it. I mean, you know, I see there's certain concentrations and stuff, but this concentration we have where it's just all going to the, you know, the same firms, the same corporations.
I actually think it's a mistake to think in terms of a partially free economy.
Because yeah, it is.
When we have an economy that's based on expanding monetary supply, that by definition is not a free economy.
No,
it's a manipulated economy.
Right, it's a manipulated economy.
And until you, going back to the tape measure analogy, until you get a tape measure that where an inch is always an inch, where a meter is always a meter, where a dollar is always worth a dollar, and that dollar value doesn't change, until you get back to that situation, you can't even claim to have something close to a free market.
I think it can change in the sense that the medium of exchange can change, and then it gets, you know, people realize that it's off and it adjusts itself. I mean, when you have this authority figure, you know, doling out the currency and telling you what the value, or trying to reach some value, that's, you know, that's where it's not going to work. I mean, I think, you know, money supply can be off just by people using it, you know, valuing it wrong, valuing it in the wrong way. But, you know, it has to adjust. It has to be competitive so it goes back. So you don't get these great giant booms and these great, you know, depressions that we get.
Well, I think it has to be more definite than that. It has to be a money supply that doesn't have any dramatic change to it in terms of its quantity. Because that's where we get into trouble. When you have large change in quantity, that's where you end up with all kinds of heck breaking loose.
Right, right. I think if money was competitive, that it wouldn't change in
point. Well, yeah, if we had competitive currencies, that would be much harder to manipulate. It's definitely true that when you have a monopoly currency, which, of course, every country in the world has, it becomes much easier for the central powers that be to manipulate it to their advantage, and they're able to do that every time. It doesn't matter whether they're private or government.
It's interesting to think what would happen if you know, we've said that a monopoly currency, you can't have a completely free market with monopoly currency. You can't have a free market. But what if they just froze the amount of currency? You know, that's an interesting kind of...
But how do you freeze it? Bear in mind, the entire currency is dependent upon the idea of fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking is going to be dependent on, you know, who's making deposits and who's taking out loans.
Right, so you can't freeze that.
How do you freeze that?
Well,
the only way you can freeze it... Well, go ahead.
You have to take the fraud out of it. You have to say, okay, if you're telling somebody that they have a deposit, then they'd have to have a deposit, which, of course, destroys banking as we know it.
That's right. It ends fractional reserve banking.
So, and
that's where I think the idea of competing currency actually comes to the fore. Right now, it's illegal to use gold and silver as money. Most people don't realize that, but it's actually illegal.
Right.
Even those people who do know will point to the legal tender laws as being the source of it. But that's actually only a circumstantial source. The actual root source, I looked it up one time, you want to write this one down, it's Title 18, Section 486, which literally says that any coins, silver and gold coins, that are not issued by the U.S. government cannot be circulated. It doesn't matter whether they are coins issued by a foreign government or coins that are issued by a private individual or a private firm, none of them can be circulated as money.
So you can't even use the euro.
That's right. Well, you wouldn't want to because the euro isn't gold or silver. But I'm saying that you can't have a gold or silver coin
from another country.
From another country. And circulate that as money. You couldn't, you know, circulate the Liberty dollar, for instance,
well,
which was a gold or silver coin.
Can you use the euro?
You could use the euro under that law, so the euro could circulate here. That would be within the law. But if the euro was based on gold or silver, then it would be illegal.
It would be illegal.
So the bottom line is that because it is totally illegal to use gold and silver as money in this country, because the only ones who are allowed to issue gold and silver that can be used is the U.S. government, and they're refusing to do it, and it's certainly not in any significant quantity that we could actually use as a currency. The bottom line is that we have no way to compete with the fiat dollar. But what if that law was reversed? What if it became legal once again? Because for many years of our country's existence, gold and silver was the form of currency. First we had a bimetal thing, and then we had a gold standard. So, I mean, not that I want to go back to the old-style gold standard because it was a very corrupted system, but if we were allowed to use gold and silver and have it compete with the fiat dollars, I think we would see a very different structure. Then we'd be getting a lot closer to what you talked about, where there would be a tremendous onus on the Fed to keep the money supply as steady as humanly possible.
Which there was, if you look at the government historically, and they would have problems all the time when gold and silver were real money. You know, they couldn't print a bunch of money. I mean,
and that's why they pushed gold out. That's why they didn't want gold around.
Exactly.
That's why they blamed gold for the crash of 29, and that's why, you know, gold was basically pushed out in a series of moves, starting with the creation of the Fed and ending with the Smithsonian Accords of the 1970s.
Right.
So, yeah, it's all interconnected, all very interesting, and kind of theoretical. But man, if we could have gold and silver used as money again, or even copper, for goodness sake, copper isn't illegal under the law. It'd be actually legal for somebody to create a copper-based money supply, and at least it would be tied to a commodity that, you know, can't be increased by large amounts. Copper, there's lots of copper that gets produced every year, so there would be some increases, but nevertheless, it wouldn't be nearly as bad as what we get with the fiat money supply.
Well, control the money supply is control the people. I mean, it's
that's right, yeah,
the way around it. And, you know, all we talk, and the spin gets me, you know, the free this, free that, free America. But, you know, there's a lot of great things about this country. I'm not saying that, but, you know, the money supply is a basic intrusion into any kind of free economy, you know.
Absolutely, and the point I was leading up to was just that, assuming we did have a competing money supply, or preferably multiple competing money supplies, man, the turnaround in this country economically would probably be dizzying. It would happen so quickly, and it would affect so many people at the lowest stratas of society and at the middle class stratas of society, and basically leave Wall Street in the dust.
It would affect
so dramatically.
The top like crazy too.
I don't think people realized how fast it would happen. Historically, whenever society has been allowed to go back to the use of gold and silver, economies that were in dire straits turned around in a matter of weeks and months. I mean, it was really, really quick.
And if you look at it from the opposite way, like you say, the 70s were the last realms of any kind of gold as a standard. And look at what's happened at the top tier of society since the 70s. I mean, all this great concentration, it started a long time ago, but, I mean, it's just really increased in the last 30 years.
Oh, yeah, ever since they went through Bretton Woods and then the Smithsonian Accords and basically went off the international gold exchange, which was, as you said, the last leg of it being removed.
Little was left.
Yeah, the whole thing has turned into just a horrible, horrible situation.
Feeding frenzy.
Oh, absolutely, a feeding frenzy. And that's actually, I want to bring up one last point, and that is that there are many people who are what we might call gold bugs, who talk about how the entire dollar will collapse. I believe ultimately it will collapse, but many of them are talking about it collapsing like next year or next 2 years or something like that. And here's what's wrong with that. There is no good currency to go to. Dollar is still the reserve currency of the world. There's not another one that we can point to and say, well, that's the logical choice to switch to now that the Fed is inflating like crazy, because none of them are in good shape.
You're exactly right. But it could weaken. I noticed that China was negotiating with, I think it was Iran, to pay for their oil in
Oh, yeah. China's trying to do a swap with Russia where they're going to keep each other's currencies as reserves and so forth. But the bottom line is it can't work. Because, first of all, China's currency is directly controlled by the government. They won't even allow it to float in any kind of a free market sense. So we know they are manipulating like crazy behind the scenes and just not telling their people about it or telling us about it. And Russia, with the ruble, I mean, the ruble is actually one of the worst currencies in the world. So
that'd
it's
be
actually
a
more of
trade.
A show of we're pissed off at the U.S. than anything else. I don't think it's actually going to have any real ramifications that they're going to be keeping each other's currencies as reserves, because they're not going to do it in any major way. There is no other good currency to go to. That's the key point.
And as long
as that's the case, the U.S. will have a lot of time to play around with manipulating its currency, basically screwing the people and enriching the people at the very top of the pyramid.
Inflating the world, right?
That's right, inflating the world. And basically, you're going to have 6 billion people paying the price of the action of a small percentage.
Yeah, what a racket, huh?
Well, unfortunately, we're near the end of the hour here, but Gene, I want to thank you very much for joining us and sitting in for another inning of relief pitching. You're getting good at it. We're going to have to invite you on to become a regular person.
We're going to have to convert to a basketball now or something.
we'll start having you back on a regular basis because you do a great job here.
Well, thanks, Walt.
We'll see you all next week on the Freedom News Hour. Goodbye, everybody.
You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction